Welcome to the Veritas Podcast. For even more exciting content, visit our website at www.veritaswbc.com. Enjoy the podcast.
When we ask the question about the reasonableness of belief, I'm going to say this on the front end. Do you have to have an argument for the existence of God to rationally believe in God? And the answer to that question is no, you don't. You don't. It's perfectly reasonable to believe in God without an argument for the existence of God. Now, that's different, and I want to say this on the front end. That is different than saying, do I have a belief in God that is grounded? And the answer is yes, even if the grounding for your belief in God isn't an argument for the existence of God. And here's the thing. The kinds of beliefs that I'm talking about here are the kinds of beliefs that everybody has, and they have no argument for it, but we're perfectly rational in accepting these beliefs. One of the people that's been really foundational in developing what it is that I'm going to be talking about tonight is a guy named Alvin Plantinga. Alvin Plantinga was a longtime professor at the University of Notre Dame. I don't know if we have any Fighting Irish people out there tonight, or at least his fans. But Alvin Plantinga came up with this idea that is usually categorized, at least under the rubric of what's called epistemology. And this is, when you talk about epistemology, you're talking about the theory of knowledge. When can I say I know something? Which is different than when I say I just believe something. But when can I make a knowledge claim here? Some of the things that get floated around is, when I was teaching a class at A&M on logic, at the beginning of the book, and I thought it was so interesting, there's this quote by a guy named W.K. Clifford. And the quote says, "It is wrong at all times and all places to believe anything without sufficient evidence." That's the quote right there at the beginning of the book. And I thought, okay, well, is there sufficient evidence for that quote to be true? And the answer was no. And I thought, okay, so a book on logic actually got it wrong on the first page. On the first page, we believe all kinds of things. What is the definition of sufficient evidence? He didn't give it. Is it empirical evidence? He didn't say it. What kind of evidence are we looking for? We don't know. But it sounds catchy, doesn't it? It is wrong at all times and all places to believe anything without sufficient evidence. When it comes to faith, and let me just tie this into religious epistemology or belief that God exists, when it comes to faith, we're talking about something very specific. The idea of faith, at least etymologically, or just meaning the root of the meaning of the word, means to have trust or confidence in. And what that means is that everybody, to some degree, is a person of faith. Whether you believe that God exists or you don't believe that God exists, you have trust or confidence in somebody. Here's an example that I like to use, at least with regard to my faith. That can be grounded in a number of things. Do I think that there are good arguments for the existence of God? The answer is absolutely I do. Do I think that there are other things that might provide a grounding for my belief in God that's solid? And the answer is absolutely. Some of those things are born from my experience, and some of those things are born from other things. And I draw this relationship out based on other relationships that I have. I think, for example, tonight of my parents. You know, would I be reasonable, or would I be rational in questioning the goodness of my parents to me based on the history of the experience that I have with my parents? And the answer is absolutely not. The only thing that my parents have been for me is they have been consistent in modeling for me, in sacrificing for me, sound principles. They put, in terms of the way that they raised me, they were consistent in the way that they guided me. Everything about them showed me who they were in terms of the content of their character. And I don't mean just in terms of the past. I'm talking about right now. And not just right now, but in terms of the future. So when I say, if somebody were to say, "Jeremy, do you have faith in your parents?" The answer is, of course I do. Now, here's the thing. Notice what I'm not doing. I'm not actually making an argument here. Instead, what I'm doing is I have some observations. And the observations that I have is that their character has always been sound. Their wisdom has always been right. They have always been consistent in the way that they have lived with me and the way that they have lived for me. And then you go, all right, now let's talk about the future. Now that's the part that hadn't happened yet, right? All I've got is the past and the present. And you go, is it rational for you to have faith in your parents? And I think everybody, if they know who they are, would say, of course, absolutely. In fact, it would be unreasonable for you not to have faith and confidence in your parents, even though we're talking about something that you haven't experienced yet. I think when we talk about faith in God, we're talking about something a lot like that. Things that are drawn from other people's experiences, as well as our personal experiences, that reveal something of the content of God's character. Now, that being said, I want to unpack this a little bit more in a way that I hope is helpful. But the idea that Alvin Plantinga developed here, he says, okay, so how does this actually work? And he says, there are some beliefs that we have that are what are called foundational beliefs. So when you think of something like a house, you know, you lay, hopefully, you lay the foundation of the house first, and then you build everything else up on top of that foundation. Now, with regard to your beliefs, here's what a foundational belief would look like. A foundational belief would be a belief that is rational, even though you're not basing it on other beliefs that you have. It's just reasonable to have that belief by itself. Let me give you some examples that as I give them to you, you'd be like, yeah, that makes sense. You actually have the belief that there are other minds here tonight, right? If nothing else, mine. But of course, you look around and you see other people. You believe in other minds. You believe that the earth is more than, say, 5 minutes old. And it's not just 5 minutes old. You're not being deceived by your experience. Instead, the earth is actually more than 5 minutes old with all the appearance of age built into it. You find all of that perfectly rational to believe, don't you? And I would agree with you, in spite of the fact that you couldn't provide an argument for either one. But pretty much everybody would agree, totally reasonable, to accept those. Notice, in spite of a lack of an argument. Some beliefs are like that. Some beliefs are what are called incorrigible beliefs. And it's virtually impossible to be in error about these beliefs, such as the belief that you're in pain. You know, I seem to be in pain right now. Or I seem to have an itch on my arm. Well, it seems that way, right? You can't be necessarily wrong about that. Some beliefs are what are called self-evident beliefs. These are beliefs that are like mathematical truths, which once you understand them, they're taken to be obviously true. Nobody's walking around wondering whether or not 2 + 2 = 4. You just take it as obviously true. Here's another category of beliefs that you don't walk around and make an argument for, but you just take them as rational. Almost all of your sensory beliefs, almost all of them. Nobody walks around and says, you know what, first, before I can say that I'm reasonable in believing what I'm experiencing here and here, I need to know for sure that my sensory experiences are right. Nobody does that. You know what you do? You walk out here, you see trees, and you just have the belief that there's a tree. Or you walk up to your friend, and you just start interacting with your friend, and you believe that your friend exists. You're not sitting there going, you know, is my friend really there? Instead, you take what is given in your experience, unless special reasons apply. Does that make sense? Unless special reasons apply. What would some of those reasons be? If you know that you were taking a hit on LSD and you're like, hey, you know what? Can't help but notice all the floating unicorns around the room right now. That would be kind of an overriding reason here. I see a unicorn. You probably don't, right? But notice in that case, you actually have a good reason in mind to question your experience. When you think of Paul's conversion, if you look at Acts, Paul has an experience of the resurrected Jesus, right? He's just put to death some believers. He's already got his next mission. He's on the Damascus Road, basically his next hit job. And when he's there, he runs into Jesus. Now, here's the thing. It wasn't just that Paul had this experience. If you remember the way that Acts reports it, others that were around also saw that something was happening. It just didn't have the clarity or the vividness of what it is that Paul was experiencing when he was having that interaction with Jesus. Was it reasonable for Paul? Was it reasonable for Paul to believe that he had seen the resurrected Jesus? Unless there's something of which we are aware, right? Something that's going on in this guy's head of which we are unaware. It was perfectly reasonable for him to think, I just had an experience of the resurrected Christ. Why? It's because it was evident to his senses. That's why. Just like the empty tomb was evident to people's senses in Jerusalem beforehand. So, some beliefs, like maybe even belief in God, are what we could call a properly basic belief. These are beliefs that when you think about it, these are foundational beliefs. And based on these foundational beliefs that, honestly, we don't even have an argument for. We might, but they're grounded in something else. We have these foundational beliefs, and up from that, we kind of build a house of knowledge that is stable. Here's what Alvin Plantinga said. He said, although beliefs of this sort are typically taken as basic, it would be a mistake to describe them as groundless. Upon having experiences of a certain sort, I believe that I'm perceiving a tree. And in the typical case, I do not hold this belief on the basis of other beliefs, like you're just having the belief, hey, there's a tree. It's nonetheless not groundless. My having that characteristic sort of experience plays a crucial role in the formation of that belief. It plays a crucial role also in its justification. So you could ask yourself something like, you could ask yourself a simple question. Was I in the kind of place, physically maybe in this case, such that that kind of belief could be formed? And if the answer to that question is yes, then it's perfectly reasonable to take, unless special reasons apply, it's perfectly reasonable to take what is given in your experience as a reliable guide to reality and thus ground it. Let me give you some other examples. Some people have an experience. Some people are ocean people. You know, they go out to the ocean, and while they're out there, they can't help but think, God must exist. Some people are mountain people. Now you're getting to me, all right? You know, the sand on the beach and swimming trunks. After a while, you go, But you go up into the mountain, right? You go up into the mountain, and you know what I'm talking about. You kind of get away from the distraction and everything else, and you have this experience, and you go, there has to be a God. For some people, it's when they have the conviction of sin. I want you to think about it. They're not saying they're going, I need an argument here. It's they literally come under the conviction of sin. And when they do it, it's perfectly reasonable in that moment to say, there has to be an other that I have offended here. Who are the candidates? Well, it's a pretty small list, right? It's perfectly reasonable right then to say, maybe it's God. Maybe it's God. Now, I want to be clear, because when you look into the Word of God, you look, for example, at 1 Corinthians chapter 15, you go earlier in 1 Corinthians, and it says, you know, the gospel is foolishness to those who don't believe. And some people would say, yeah, so what Paul's telling you here is don't make an argument for the existence of God. I'm like, that's not what Paul's telling you there. Because it's the same Paul writing there in the earlier part of 1 Corinthians that in 1 Corinthians 15 is like, now I want to give you the evidence for the resurrection of Jesus. Same guy, same letter. Instead, what he's doing in 1 Corinthians 15 is he's invoking evidence for the resurrection of Jesus. And he does it in a creed, basically, in 1 Corinthians 15, verses 3 through 8. That which has been handed down to me, now I hand down to you. And he goes on to talk about the appearances of Jesus and even encourages people to go and talk to the witnesses of what transpired in Jerusalem at the time of Jesus' death and what happened after the death of Jesus. All of that to say this: do you have to have an argument for the existence of God to rationally believe in God? I think the answer to that is no. Are there good reasons for thinking God exists, and should we be able to provide them? And I think the answer to that is yes. And here's why. Suppose that you're the type of person that's the beach person, right? And as you were out at the beach, you know, you had this religious experience that just completely overwhelmed you. And you came to the belief that God exists. And then you fast forward about, you know, 6 months down the road, you're sitting in a coffee shop somewhere, maybe $4, right? For those of you who've been around, you know that's Starbucks, right? But you're sitting in $4 and you're drinking your latte that isn't nearly as good as what we provide here, right? I mean, that's a shout out to our friends here at Avid Coffee Roasters. Now, so you're sitting there and you're thinking, right? And somebody comes over to you and they start this conversation with you and they say, you know what? If you look at the world and you look at all the suffering and the evil in the world, it gives you good reasons for thinking God doesn't exist. By the way, still the number one objection to the existence of God is the problem of evil. Now, that being said, you might look at me and go, you know what? But I had this ocean experience. And when I had that ocean experience, I just came to the belief that God exists. Well, fair enough, you did. And by the way, totally reasonable in that moment. However, now that you have an objection to your belief, you've got some thinking that you have to do. because the objection itself provides what we might call a defeater for your belief, such that if it's true, it gives you good positive reasons for thinking God doesn't exist. And in that case, guess what you need to do? Friends, you need to do some homework, and you need to do some thinking, and you need to help people along in thinking, how is it that evil and God can maybe coexist, or how it is that the amount of evil that there is in the world and the kinds of evil that there are in the world and the distribution of evil that you find in the world, it makes total sense for a God who is omniscient, omnipotent, and omnibenevolent to permit this kind of stuff to go on. It won't do, basically, to say at that time, you know what? I had an experience, and it doesn't matter what you say. I had an experience. That's not helping that person think through things very well. And so we need to take up the mantle and think with them. At least that's my two cents. Now, all of that is basically setting up what I hope is a good Q&A. I want to bring the chairs over here in a second, but I want to be clear about something. Simply because a person doesn't have an argument for the existence of God doesn't mean that the belief in God is groundless. It doesn't mean that. It means it's grounded in something else. Make sense? It could be something like an experience or something else. But a grounded belief is still a perfectly rational belief. All right, so while Melody's working her way up here, I want to give you an example of a conversation that I had basically just a couple of weeks ago. And it was more or less on this same kind of question. So the person I was visiting, and it was at $4, in case you're curious. So I'm sitting in $4, and the person has a little bit of a Buddhist background. So it was a fun conversation. Here was the thing. So we're having this conversation. They said, well, you know, when it comes to your belief in Christianity, do you have good positive reasons for thinking Christianity is true? And I said, absolutely, I do. And so we started talking about those things. But I wanted to be clear to point something out. And the thing that I was trying to point out was basically this. Maybe what it is that you're looking for is something different from what you've got. Maybe it's just different from what you've got. So when you think about your worldview, and everybody has one, there's no such a thing as a person that comes from a neutral place. I just want to, everybody is biased. Everybody. That includes me. That doesn't matter, right? I mean, as I've told you before, it would be a little bit weird for me to say, you know, I think Christianity is true. I'm not biased toward it. You would probably find that weird. Instead, what it is I think that we're looking for, and much like what I had in the conversation with my Buddhist friend, he just wants me to be fair. That's it. That's it. And so we want to be fair. Now, when I say, you know, you've had that ocean experience and you came to the belief that God exists, or you had that mountaintop experience and you came to the belief that God exists, does that mean that any belief whatsoever is just okay because you had some experience? And the answer is no, not at all. I've already given you some reasons for thinking that. But one of the reasons for thinking what I'm talking about is an acceptable way of looking at it is this. Suppose for a second that God actually exists. And suppose for a second that what God did is when he created us inherently with a sense of his existence and awareness. And as you go out into the world, you go out onto the mountaintop or you go to the ocean, and there's that thing in you. Alvin Plantinga calls it, you know, borrowing from John Calvin, there's the sensus divinitatis. There is this sense of the divine. It's already there. And what you have is you have an experience of the world that triggers that. He said that can only happen if you have a God that already put that in there for you so that the experience can trigger it. One of the key differences between me and my Buddhist friend, by the way, functionally at least, Buddhism, at least in its roots, doesn't even believe God exists. There is no creator out there. There isn't one, so to speak, that orders us to have these kinds of beliefs. So does it give us reason for thinking that any belief whatsoever at any time is rational just because I had an experience of something? And the answer is no, not at all. Now, so what I want to do is I want to turn to some questions. In the coming weeks, just a heads up, I pointed out a few things about religious experiences. Some of you have asked some questions to me personally about religious experiences, so I'm going to turn to that next week. What are the different kinds of religious experiences? And when can I say those are trustworthy versus, that one's got to go? You know, what are the things that I should be looking for? And then we'll get into some reasons for thinking, like actual arguments for the existence of God after that. But for now, how about questions? Does that sound good? All right, let's do it.
All right, guys, so if you will head to menti.com, you can put in our code 68743, and you can pull up the questions that have already been asked and vote for those, as well as submitting your own questions. Right now, we only have three questions, so come on, guys.
Right.
You got to throw
No, that's okay.
That. No, it's
Last
not.
Last week, there were like 100.
Well, so. Yes, that is true.
That's all right.
That's true. That's okay. Okay, so we're going to dive right in here. I'm going to try to keep us on topic as much as possible,
okay.
But there's some good questions.
Good.
Okay. So maybe you can help us out here with some definitions. Does belief have to be reasonable and logical?
Does a belief have to be reasonable and logical?
Or does it help?
Well, it helps. Yeah, absolutely, it helps. Notice, nothing that I said tonight was saying, hey, be as irrational as you can possibly be. What I was trying to do is to say, we need to come to a different understanding of what rational is. Because if we deny what I'm talking about tonight, a lot of your beliefs that you take as reasonable aren't. They aren't. Your experiences, right? Your sensory beliefs. If you deny what I'm talking about tonight, then most of your sensory beliefs are not rational. So that's why I was saying what I was trying to say. It's important for our belief to be coherent. If you find that there's something in what you believe that's incoherent, that gives you good positive reasons for thinking it's false, right? If you're contradicting yourself, it gives you good positive reasons for thinking that your belief is false. That being said, coherence is only a part of what we're talking about here. It can't be everything. And here's why I say that. Y'all probably know that I'm a C.S. Lewis fan. I'm also a Tolkien fan, J.R.R. Tolkien, right? Now, here's the thing. Tolkien creates Middle Earth, right? So for those of you that have read his novels, he creates Middle Earth. Or for those of you that are more C.S. Lewis fans, he writes the Chronicles of Narnia, right? And you've got all that. Now, think about it. Those stories are perfectly coherent. Here's the catch. They're just not real. They're just not real. Coherence is only a part of the story here. There are other things that are necessary in what we're talking about. So we want to be reasonable. What I'm trying to do is to say we need to rethink what it means to be reasonable, right? So some of the things that I was talking, that's why I was saying, think about the example with my parents. I have faith and trust in my parents. Why do I have faith and trust in my parents? Because of everything that I've observed. Everything that I've observed. Well, the same thing that you would say about God. What's everything that you've observed about God? And that's more than just my experience. I'm talking about as revealed, for example, in his word. What do you find? God is good, God's trustworthy, God's merciful, and so forth. So, anyway, I don't know if that explicitly addresses the question, but again, we have to get to a place where we're re-understanding what it means to have a rational belief. But I was also trying to be fair. When somebody provides an argument against your belief, notice what I said. I gave the example of the problem of evil, and I said, at that point, you need to do some thinking, because for whatever experience you had, on the ocean or at the ocean, now you have a potential defeater for your belief. Some have even said that the existence of evil and God cannot coexist, and that would give you reasons logically to say God doesn't exist. I'm not dealing with that tonight, by the way. That's coming up in a couple of weeks. Here's another one for you. This one's free of charge, Melody. But how about when a Muslim will say your belief in the Trinity, you're inherently contradicting yourself. When you say that God is three and one, you're contradicting yourself. That, by the way, right there, you can't sit there and go, but you know what? I had this amazing experience out when I was at the ocean. No, because what they're showing is you're contradicting yourself, or they're trying to show. Right? So what do you do then? You can't sit there and lean on the experience. Instead, you have to say something about the coherence of the doctrine of the Trinity, which, by the way, you've already asked if I would do something on the Trinity. And so the answer is yes. It's coming up a little bit later. Have we contradicted ourselves? And the answer is no, we haven't, but I'll explain that later.
So you're really disappointing me, because I was excited that I didn't really have to have a rational, argument for the existence of God. And then you're telling me that I have to, think about all these defeatier things.
Well, right. Well, I mean, again, if you have somebody that's come up with a good question, then you need to provide a good answer. But that's different than saying, I had this experience that grounded my belief. And by grounding it, it makes it rational. Okay. It's rational.
Okay, so this will take that a step further then. So are there any simple facts that we can share with a non-believer other than our experience?
Facts. Yeah, absolutely. So, look, for me, here's the thing. You know, when a person is asking me something about God, I'm going to be a little bit like Paul, right? And Paul had a number of ways that he approached people. So, you know, if you look in Acts, it says that when Paul was in the synagogue, he reasoned with them from the scriptures. That's what he always did. Here's why. Because when he's in the synagogue, he's already with like-minded people, at least in one sense. They believe God exists. So Paul's not sitting there going, you know what, I think I need to come up with an argument for the existence of God for these people. He didn't. Instead, what he had to do is to explain something about the uniqueness of Christianity and to show them that they're not there and that they need to get there. So he reasoned with them from the scriptures. Usually probably what he was going to do is invoke something from the Old Testament to talk about how all of this was pointing to Jesus and fulfilled in the cross and in the resurrection. However, you look over at Acts chapter 17, Paul's in the Areopagus, and he doesn't do that. He doesn't do that. Instead, he's sitting there with basically a bunch of Greek kind of thinking people, and he's totally the visiting team, by the way. I mean, the deck is stacked against him, but it doesn't say that he reasoned with them from the scriptures. Instead, he starts quoting Epimenides, "In him we live and move and have our being." And then he goes, okay, so who is in him? Who is he? And then he turns, he says, I notice that you have all these statues, all these gods that you worship. You know, I want to talk with you about the one that's the unknown God so that you might know him. And what does he talk about? He talks about the same thing that you find in the early parts of Acts. If you look at Acts chapters 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, flip over even to Acts chapter 10. And what were all of the sermons about when the church began? And it was very simple, that he died and that he rose. That was it. That was it. That's what they were preaching. By the way, that can make my job on a Sunday morning so much easier, right? I could get up there every Sunday and go, Jesus died and he rose. Hugh, come on up and lead us in a song, right? That was basically what they were preaching. Then the question becomes, is there good positive reasons for thinking that he rose? Good positive reasons. And at that point you say, all right, What are the earliest stories that we have about the teachings of Jesus? That, by the way, is the Bible. And more specifically, Mike Lacona says, I don't even need the Gospels for this. All I need is Paul and 1 Corinthians 15. It's the earliest narrative that we've got. The earliest narrative that we got is right there. He says, so, and what do they all speak to? They all speak to the eyewitnesses that spoke of the events pertaining to his death and his bodily appearing to people over a 40-day period, of course, before he ascends. And so there you go. That's why like a Mike Lacona, William Lane Craig, a Gary Habermas, among others, will say, hey, let's start with places that nobody's disagreeing. What does everybody agree on? And it's pretty simple. That Jesus lived, that he died on the cross, that the tomb was empty, right? And by the way, the early church in Jerusalem exploded largely because the testimony was all the same. That dead guy was walking. All of that should count, when you think about it, as evidence, not just for the existence of God, but something very specific for Christianity itself.
It's really good. Okay, so we're thinking about rational arguments here. And logical arguments. Let's talk about scientific arguments. Why do people think that the Bible is scientific? If belief does not need to be rational or logical, then science is not a factor in belief. True?
Except that I do think your beliefs need to be rational, and I do think your beliefs need to be logical. That was actually kind of the point of the whole talk, except to say we need to understand what rationality actually is, and it's not what most people think. So that's why I was starting there, right? And as far as science is concerned, I mean, here's the tenet that I accept. What I believe about the Word of God, it is true to with regard to everything to which it speaks. It is not, when you think about it, a guide to everything in the sense of go back into Genesis 1 and Genesis 2, and there God is giving you the mechanics of how he created. Go look, it's not there. It isn't there. The focus in Genesis 1 and Genesis chapter 2 is completely different. The focus in Genesis 1 and 2 is the who of creation. Who did this? not the mechanics of it. How did he do this? Look, I've been digging. I haven't found the mechanics of creation in the Bible just yet. And that's why I don't have a problem with saying, hey, there's some places that science helps us out. That's good. That's good. Notice that some of the conclusions that science have come to, we found to be very compatible with our Christian belief. You know, that our universe had a beginning, and that the beginning of the universe literally was the beginning of space and time. Doesn't that gel pretty nicely, at least with what we've conceived of in the creation narrative itself in Genesis chapter 1 and Genesis chapter 2? I think the answer to that is yes. What are the characteristics of God? We usually describe God as, you know, as essentially spaceless. He's incorporeal. God doesn't, you know, God doesn't have a body and so forth. But when you think of physical stuff, it's located in space and time. Doesn't that seem to fit pretty nicely with other Christian beliefs that we have? So I don't have any problem with science. By the way, we've changed the way that we interpret passages of Scripture because of scientific discoveries. So what? All that means is that we needed to change our interpretation based on better evidence. And that's why I go, that's fine. So when you had the belief that, you know, the earth was the center of the universe, right? We're a far cry from that now. But when it was there and you have the motion of the stars and so forth, there were certain psalms and certain passages of Scripture that we just flat got wrong because it was based on the wrong model of the universe. Do I lose any sleep over that? Nope. I sit there and I say, hey, science helped us out there. That's a good thing. And we needed to change our interpretation. I don't have any problem with that at all. That's where I'm saying I think evidence really does help. Once you make these discoveries, you do have to ask the question, is it really incompatible with your Christian belief? I think that's fine. But we're not finding that really any of these things are troubling. By the way, Michio Kaku, he's a professor of physics up at New York University. And there was an interesting interview with him. He said, when you talk about theoretical physicists, he said, we tend to be a very spiritual people. And one of the reasons he said we're a very spiritual people is, he said, there is a mathematical precision to the universe that is hard to comprehend if there isn't something like God out there. It's just hard to comprehend it. Where you typically find people that struggle a little bit more with belief in God is when you maybe shift over to like a department of biology, right? And specifically, let me be clear about this. Biology is one thing. Like when you're dissecting and stuff like that, you know, you can do that and you can put flags in. You know what I'm talking about, where you identify organs, you know, give Latin names, you can give function and so forth. Evolutionary biology is not the same thing as biology. Evolutionary biology is actually, when you think about it, is a philosophy of science that is invoked to explain some things. Nothing wrong with that, but we just need to make sure that we keep something clear. That's why somebody like a Richard Dawkins, by the way, who's not exactly a friend of Jesus, that is an understatement, by the way, all right? But, you know, even Richard Dawkins says this. He says, you know, Darwin, what did he provide? You look at the origin of species, Darwin can tell you what he provided. He never provided an origin of species. That isn't what evolution did. And in fact, that was what he said. I set out to unpack this and to discover this, only to find that's not what I got. Because the only thing that evolution does is it works on things that already exist. So it's not a story of origins. Like, he got it. This is why maybe when you look at the origin of species, over 200 times the idea of a creator comes up. What he meant by that's debated, but at least it comes up. And this is what Richard Dawkins would then go on to say. He says, yeah, so what we're looking for is for physics to have its Darwin moment. And why would he say something like that? It's because the story of origins from a purely scientific angle has actually not definitively been provided. Let me tell you what the number one theory is out there aside from belief in God. You know what it is now? It's called the multiverse theory. That's what it is. And here's the base. Let me give it in a thumbnail sketch, all right? But here's the basic idea, is that there are potentially an infinite number of other universes other than the one that we inhabit. And the whole idea is these universes, so to speak, they spawn other universes. One analogy that's given is like how bubbles can pop other bubbles off, right? They spawn other universes. And if you don't have an infinite number of them, you have a huge number of them. And so a universe just like ours was almost certain to happen totally by accident. Now, here's what I find interesting about that. The number one thing, the number one, at least in science, the number one thing that is usually brought up that says, here's why it is more reasonable to accept that the universe is closed and that there's no divine intervention from the outside, is because of what's called the Occam's razor. It's called the principle of simplicity. And here's the idea. We don't have to explain the natural and the supernatural. We just have to explain the natural. It's the principle of simplicity. The catch is that rather than saying there's one God who created, now they're saying there are perhaps an infinite number of other universes. That, by the way, John Polkinghorne, who's a professor of physics at Cambridge, says that we've never observed. We have no idea what they're like, but apparently they have all the explanatory power that they need to explain the features of our own, and that's more reasonable than to believe that God exists. So you've lost it on a number of levels, one of which is you've got perhaps an infinite number of other universes versus one God. So if you're going to invoke the principle of simplicity, well, guess who wins? God's probably going to win. So I don't have any problem with science. I think that's a good thing. I've given this example before when I think of a friend up in Carolina and he would wear this shirt. You know, it says science. You either believe in it or you don't. So they're going, well, who doesn't? Who doesn't? It's different to say, I believe in science, and to say science necessarily leads to the belief that God doesn't exist. And by the way, historically speaking, that's also been false.
Anybody else's mind blown by that? Deep stuff. Okay.
And free of charge, too. So.
Okay. So obviously belief is a big deal. And,
sure.
And we see that all throughout Scripture, that God leaves it to our belief, our faith in him, to come to salvation. So this is a popular question. Why did God leave it up to us to believe instead of making it to where we just didn't even have a choice?
Why did God leave it up to us to believe and just basically eradicate the possibility of a choice whatsoever?
That whole free will question.
Yeah, okay. Now, one, I've already told you I have to unpack that because you've been asking how does free will work? That should take max 10 minutes. I'm kidding. That's a complicated question, so we're going to devote ourselves to that another time. But
you have exactly 1 minute.
I have 1 minute, so let me do that. Look, and here's the thing with regard, and I do believe this. I think that there is something when you talk about what love is, when you really think about what love is, love is something that is directed toward an object that you are choosing to have that relationship with. At the end of the day, that's what love is. What you don't want to say is that since we can skip the idea that there's a mind, there is no mind, there's just a brain, and there's only brain states, that really what my love for my mom or my dad or my wife or my children is a neuron firing. And then every behavior that I have is basically a byproduct of those neurons firing. Notice that eradicates the idea of a choice in behaviors to any of them. Instead, I start from a different place. One, I think it's reasonable to believe that God exists. But the other thing is that I see that there are certain things about God that love is diffusive of itself, right? There's an object of love. And there's also a choice to love. So it probably lets the cat out of the bag a little bit as to what I think. There is something, so to speak, up to us as to whether or not we're going to make that choice, whether or not to love God, whether or not to love Jesus, whether or not to love others. I think in the end that's going to be up to us. Because if you think about it, the idea of love on the other side makes no sense at all, right? It makes no sense at all. A love that is not freely chosen and love that's not freely given isn't love, period.
That's good stuff.
That's a short answer. You said I had a minute, and I took a minute. So
yeah, that's exactly a minute.
There you go.
That's very good. All right, so we have a few more questions, and we will be posting those to social media later this week. And if you miss it, we will have it on the screen before Veritas next week. Do you want to highlight again where we're going next week?
Yeah, so next week, I talked a little bit about experiences, but some people really question religious experiences. And so I want to, before I even get to next week, I want to ask this question. Anybody in this room want to admit that you've had a religious experience? Can I see a show of hands here? You don't have to be shy about it. Has anybody in the room had a religious experience? All right. It's funny. Let me ask you this question. How many people in this room believe that God exists? Can I see your hands? All right, that's interesting. Can I go back to my first question? How many people in this room have had a religious experience? Can I see your hands again? Oh, see, I got a little bit more of that time. Yeah. Here's why I did that. One is because I wanted to mess with you for a second. But the other thing is this. There's not just one kind of religious experience. There are a number of kinds of religious experiences. But is it reasonable to trust those things when I have them? That's a different question. And given the prominence of what's reported and the kinds of religious experiences, because a lot of you, I think, are now admitting that you've had one, if nothing else, how many of you have said, I've had a salvation experience with Jesus? That's a religious experience of a sort. How can I know that I can trust that? It's pushed back on. So we're gonna jump to that next week.
Awesome. Well, I hope you guys can join us. Again, follow us on social media. We'll be posting some stuff this week. We're going to try to get even more stuff up on social media throughout the week. So be sure to check those out. And if on your way out you feel so led to drop something in the box, we'd really appreciate it. And we will see you all next week.
Indeed. Have a great week. Good
Thanks,
to see you.
Guys.
We hope you have enjoyed the podcast. For more information on Veritas, visit www.veritaswbc.com.